The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
I mean, it blows my mind. We're so hung up on this notion that we have some obligation to help the struggling black man, you know, cut him some slack until he can overcome these historical injustices. It's crap. This stuff you guys are saying just perpetuates it. All this liberal nonsense, you know, everyone's turning and looking the other way while our country rots from the inside out.
Well, Jews have been persecuted for over 5,000 years. Are you saying that it's wrong to feel sensitive about anti-Semitism?
No, forget that.
I'm with you. I'm with you all the way, baby. I'm so sick of these liberal hypocrites.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
There will be no peace in the foreseeable future. The verdict of our guest today on the subject of Israel and all related issues to that current controversy is not a positive one. As a veteran of the October 1973 Yom Kippur War, Jacob Peretz shared his historical outlook and some personal experiences with Robert Vaughn in a March 29th video released on Just Right's various online video channels. And of course, as is usually the case, our video presentations are much longer than the broadcast time of this audio version, and so today's audio broadcast zeroes in on the essentials of their discussion. And to hear more, our video presentations are always accessible from Just Right's homepage. Now, one thing I've certainly had demonstrated for myself lately is that whenever people get involved in differences of opinion over Israel and the Mideast never-ending crises, there seems to be an extraordinary emotional and polarized reaction to those discussions. It's another one of those cleverly crafted divisive issues, isn't it? So let's see how today's discussion fares, because remember, you can always write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
Our guest today is Jacob Peretz, an Israeli-Canadian businessman, a veteran of the Yom Kippur War of 1973, and he joins me today to discuss the ongoing events in Israel, Palestine, and how they impact himself and his own opinion on how to move forward. Welcome, Jacob. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you please start off by giving me your reaction to the events of October 7th, 2023?
Well, this is very similar to what happened in the Holocaust. This is really an attempt at extermination, genocide of Jewish people. When they just walk in, whether it's Hamas people, whether it's citizens, whether it's UNRWA members, whether it's media reporters, they all participated in it, the ones that came in. And there was an orgy of slaughtering. That's how I see it. It's a very, very sad situation.
Do you have any family or friends in the kibbutzim that are around Gaza?
I have family very, very close to Gaza. Fortunately for them and for me, they were a bit further away, maybe a kilometer further away or two. So they didn't really reach his house, but he was in a shelter the whole day and the whole night because there was bombs and rockets and all over the time. Luckily, they have the shelters that can keep them, protect them.
It has been suggested by an Israeli podcaster that the events of October 7th were only able to happen because of complicitness of the Israeli government. The border was not as protected as it should have been at that time. The troops were not there in their normal contingent, and it took hours for them to react. The allegation is out there that the Israeli government may have allowed this to happen. What do you think about that?
Okay, I will be very careful when I say the Israeli government. The Israeli government was elected democratically. They formed a coalition like they do every time. There are too many parties. There's not enough votes for any party to form a coalition by itself. It's very similar to what the Liberals have with LNDP. Here in Canada, the NDP is supporting them, and they are milking them. They are squeezing them for all kinds of things that they want. So they formed a coalition, but this is the first time that they were able to form a coalition with like-minded views, with right-wing parties. Usually there is one or two left-wing parties in a coalition. This is the first time that there was a right-wing coalition. And each one of these parties, they were talking about it for a long time, as long as they could, but they didn't have the power. They wanted to modify the Supreme Court, the judicial system. They wanted to correct things that went wrong in the 1990s after the death of Rabin. The Supreme Court took too much power on themselves autocratically. They are not elected. They are not voted in. They decide what law is going to hold, what law is not going to hold. They elect members from within. So they try to correct it. Now, people are saying that they objected to the government taking these steps, but there is enough evidence to show that there was a resistance. The resistance was brewing before the election. And the resistance was brewing by minorities, leftist parties that do not like Netanyahu. And they didn't know what would be the cause of it, but they planned to riot and they planned to do all of those things. So when the judicial reform came up in the parliament, in the Knesset, that was their cue. And they used it as an excuse to attack the government in demonstrations, in articles in the paper. Most of the media are similar to North America. Most of the media is leftist, and they support this view. And it was very, very difficult to continue like this. Some of the key people, some of the leaders of these people, they recruited army officers during this campaign of shaming of the government. And they are saying, we are not going to fight for a dictator. So when you say the government, there were enough people within the army, ex-generals and generals, when people claim that they are not going to fight for a dictator, they're not fighting for the dictator, they're fighting for the country. And the chief of staff and the generals in the army did nothing to discipline them. You would think if somebody is claiming he's not going to fight, he's not going to come to the army to refuse an order, that's a big problem. But they did not do anything. So there's talk, it's known that the chief of staff and intelligence people were talking the night before about the situation. There was a situation with a SIM card. Apparently Hamas, over the period of time, collected Israeli SIM cards. And a number of times in the past, just to mislead the army, they used them widely and then they stopped. So they thought they didn't take too much of it, but they did discuss it. They never thought to alert the prime minister. So when they say government, again, I will be very, very careful saying that, because when they hide things from the prime minister, and there is a long history of trying to get rid of him, there are claims, there are court cases which are falling apart. Still in a war, he has to be in court. And still in a war, all the witnesses that come, they turn out that they are wrong, they are false witnesses. So the cases hold nothing, they hold no water, the cases. And it's possible the army knew. In fact, the chief of intelligence, he let people go, he took responsibility. He was on vacation by himself. They contacted him. They could not get a hold of him. He let go of a lot of people. And when the chief of staff had the meeting and they knew there was some situation that could happen, they figured we'll go and talk in the morning without alerting any army units, without alerting the Air Force, without alerting extra units. They did nothing. So yes, there was some responsibility of leadership, but not the government. The leadership was within the army, and it is well known in Israel.
It would seem to me beyond comprehension that anybody in Israel, any Israeli, whether they're in the government or in the military, as you were for 3 years, would allow something like the events of October 7th to happen at all. Yet these days, we've seen so many things happen with our own governments, especially in the West, that I will never put it past people to do evil deeds, whether they are on the other side or on our side. So is what you're saying that there is a fog of war that is happening right now that we really don't know why it took so long for the troops to respond to the attack on 7th? And you're suggesting that we don't immediately blame the government of Bibi Netanyahu and the Likud party. We should look at all of the elements that are surrounding this, including generals, a dissatisfaction with Benjamin Netanyahu's government by labor and other Israelis. And so we just can't leap to that conclusion yet. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, it's too early to find out all the details. Everyone bears some responsibility. There's some responsibility. Even Netanyahu as a prime minister, he's still the top of the country, he's still the prime minister. But when these key people that are supposed to do their job, and they're not informing him, and they're not doing their job, and they're not alerting, they're not putting more units, they're not alerting the army, they're not alerting the airports, prepare a few helicopters ready. Because a few helicopters, it would have gone by there, it would have stopped it. But they were not prepared. They didn't do it. I really think that what has happened, they were hoping that something would happen. They never expected it to be this big. And the figure, just to show him that, you know, we're not going to do it for you. This is what's causing it.
Hmm.
Look in the U.S. They're saying maybe 10 million people came in. How many are Chinese? How many are from Iran? They're not peace-loving people. You can't leave China or Iran just like that to come to the U.S.
Well, that's true, yes.
Okay. It is very important for your viewers to hear the following definition. The definition of terrorism is the deliberate targeting of innocent civilians. That is what Hamas specializes in. That is what Hamas did
on October 7th. And that's what is happening in Gaza
now,
also.
Is what Israel is doing terrorism? No, for the following reason. And again, you can lie about this if you want, but do not expect not to be challenged about it. What the IDF is doing is the same manner of war as the British Army, the American Army, and all other armies in the civilized world. They target terrorists like Hamas, and there are civilian casualties. Yes, there are. But it is not the aim of the IDF, any more than it is of the British or American armies, to target civilians. And anyone who pretends otherwise is lying to the public watching.
My dad was born a few hours out of Jerusalem. My mom was born in Utah, so both places where Jesus got resurrected. So my grandma was a Palestinian refugee in 1948. She fled her home. It's a very sad story, but she went to Beirut, met my grandpa there, so I find it romantic because her being a refugee gave him his opening line. He just like, want to come back to my place? She's like, we have a place? Mom, Dad, this guy has a place. Let's go. And now, 70 years later, I'm doing my part as an Arab American to promote peace in the Middle East. I'm dating an Israeli woman. And you should be happy for me, okay? She's beautiful. She's out of my league, man. I'm like, ah, why are you settling? Why? It's got me occupied. We share a joint account at Bank of the West, the West Bank. You know what I'm talking about now? It's a metaphor.
The events of the 7th, we saw, I think, the figures are over 1,000 Gazans came into Israel and performed.
More like 3,000 to 4,000.
Oh, really? That high?
Yeah.
But it's my understanding that at first it was Hamas. It was an organized type of a strike, opening up the gates, so to speak, actually physically opening up the gates with bulldozers and things of that nature. They went in and they did their nasty deeds to only be followed by regular Gazans.
Yes.
in the thousands. Now you're telling me in the thousands to continue with the atrocities. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's also, it's not only in one place. It's a pretty long border.
It is.
As small as Gaza is, it's still a long border. And they penetrated in many places. And they attacked simultaneously in a number of villages, a number of kibbutzim, a number of towns, a number of villages, and destroyed them completely. There was a lady that was released after the 53 days, the first exchange, and she has an article. There was an article in the New York Times. They interviewed her for 8 hours. It took that long for her to talk as to what happened to her in captivity. And she's saying they would come to her with a gun and force her to do sexual things. And then they beat her up while she was in captivity. And she's worried what happened to the other women who are there now. Now, Hamas is trying to say, come up with a story that Israeli soldiers are raping Palestinian women. You know, they are so, they don't even need to try hard. There is such a willingness in the West to listen to them and take their words as the Bible. They take their word as the truth. Every time they say something, the West, the media in the West jumps and accuses Israel of rape and atrocities and genocide and killing civilians.
I have to take these things with a grain of salt, especially in a situation of conflict and war, because we all know from history that nobody has lily white hands when it comes to the actions of individual soldiers given weapons and allowed to go and kill people. Abu Ghraib comes to mind in Vietnam. There's always atrocities on both sides. Israelis are not immune to this, given the tens of thousands of soldiers that they have being put into a situation where they may do nasty things. But I don't want to focus on those things. I want to focus on the big geopolitical decisions that are being made, because we can always point to atrocities by individual soldiers or groups of soldiers on both sides that are going to muddy the waters, except for the fact that they change opinion. They change opinion here in the West if they're being pushed by a media that likes one side or the other. Then they become important. It's important to point them out whether or not it's correct or not. Yeah. But would you agree that, you know, atrocities are done by people on both sides, United States, Israel, Hamas, Palestinians, Jordanians, it doesn't matter. These nasty things happen in war, don't they?
Well, I will object to it, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the history of Arab culture, of conquest, of conquering, they're slaughtering and they're killing. The last time Jewish people went to war on their own was more than 2,000 years ago. Where have they gone to war? Who did they go to war against? They fought the Nazis. They fought the British. In fact, Jewish soldiers participated with the British in conquering Israel from the Ottoman Empire. They fought alongside the British, and there was big arguments in Israel at the time. Should they join the British in the Second World War? Because some of them were saying the enemies of the British also are enemies, the Nazis. We have to help them. And some others were saying, but they still don't let people come into the country where they were supposed to do that. They had a mandate to facilitate it, but they put an embargo. They would not let Jewish people from Europe come in. Had they done that, hundreds of thousands of Jews would have been able to leave Europe. Because initially Germany wanted to get rid of the Jews. They didn't really want to kill them right away. But no one would take them. And the British prevented them from coming into Israel.
At least at the end of the war, they tried to turn back and were successful in turning back ships, you know, with Jews trying to get to Palestine. But during the time between the Balfour Declaration in 1919 and the League of Nations at San Remo in 1920, League of Nations 22, and the Mandate, all the way up to the war, almost 500,000 European Jews left Europe to colonize Palestine, because originally there was about 65,000 in Palestine from the Jordan over to the Mediterranean. And now that ballooned with the hope of establishing a national home in Palestine by the Balfour Declaration to 500,000. So it was only near the last few years before 48 that Britain came in conflict with Israelis, who weren't really called Israelis then, they were Jews at the time. So is that the period you're talking about, 45 to 48?
No.
No?
In the 30s. In the 30s, they restricted immigration of Jews. And those that came, and I don't know about these numbers, but there were a lot less. Those that came, came illegally. A lot of them came illegally. And when they were caught, they were sent back. Later on, we established internment camps in Cyprus, in Kenya, in Uganda, in Eritrea, whatever other countries. But in the 30s, they had the Peel Commission, and they reduced the size of the land that was allocated. See, during the mandate was to facilitate a creation of the Jewish state in Palestine. Palestine is from the Mediterranean Sea all the way to the Euphrates in Iraq. And don't forget, when they did that, they created Iraq, they created Syria, they created Lebanon. So they created other countries. It's not like that all of a sudden nothing, everything was existing before. There was nothing existing before. There was an Arab land. There was a Turkish Ottoman occupied land, and there was an Arab people. They were moving from one place to another. They didn't live in Iraq or they didn't live in Israel. Many of them were nomads. They would come and wander different places. Some of them were transient workers. There were farms, there were agricultural places because there was no industry during the Turkish Ottoman Empire. So they would come, they would work a farm, they would work for 2 or 3 years, but the rent was so high, they weren't able to keep it. So they had to move on. They went to another place and try again. So these were not people that lived there from time immemorial. There's a book written by, I don't know if he's still alive, John Peters, an American, who went to the Middle East to write a book from time immemorial to prove that the Palestinians were there from, as I said, from time immemorial. She wrote a very thick book. And as she went to Israel, she went to Turkey, she went to Britain, she went to all the archives in different places, and her conclusions were totally different, very much supporting of Israel and the Jewish people in Israel. So going back to the mandate, their job was to facilitate a state. The military and the Foreign Affairs Department, Foreign Affairs Ministry, they had different thoughts. They did not want to create a Jewish state. The U.S. was not interested in hearing about it. Nobody was really there. Nobody was there to help the Jews. They were supposed to, but they didn't do it. They prevented them from coming in. At the same time, they encouraged Arabs to come in from other places. And the Jews came and set up moshavot and kibbutzim and settlements and created light industry or farming. They needed labor because they couldn't get Jewish people to come. They had to hire Arab labor. And this Arab labor became the Palestinian refugees.
Let me take the contrary point of view here for a moment, just for a debate. The League of Nations said, and I'm going to quote here regarding the mandatory territories, they were, quote, inhabited by peoples not yet able to stand by themselves under the strenuous conditions of the modern world. And so the tutelage of such peoples should be entrusted to advanced nations who, by reason of their resources, their experience, or their geographical position, can undertake the responsibility as a sacred trust of civilizations. They were to provide administrative advice and assistance by a mandatory until such time as they, meaning the indigenous people of these areas, were able to stand alone. So was the British mandate, you mentioned Syria, Lebanon, those were French mandates, was the British mandate through the Balfour Declaration, which they inserted into Article 22 of the League of Nations, were they reneging on their responsibility by allowing up to 500,000, up until the 30s, as you might say, allowing the initial Balfour Declaration to inspire hundreds of thousands of European Jews to come into that territory, which did not seem to me, at least when I'm reading this, to be the intent of the League of Nations, which was to hold the territory, administer the law until as such time that the people who are living there could establish a firm government. So let me just posit that to you for a moment, that maybe the British screwed up back in the 20s when they allowed that to happen. Your thoughts?
They screwed up big time. But don't forget, when the British mandate was given, Palestine included Jordan. So this is a huge area. a huge, huge piece of land.
Yes, and then they broke that off, Transjordan, went
okay.
to Jordan.
But the British did, not the Mandate, not the League of Nations. It's the British themselves that did it. And then they did it again through the Peel Commission, which was again in 1947 with the UN. Do you know the population of Israel, excluding what they call the West Bank, Judea and Samaria? There are 10 million people in Israel. And there's room probably for 10 more. There are so many areas that are still uninhabited. So saying that they couldn't have a few hundred Jews coming in to a much larger area really doesn't hold water. They did not want Jews to come in. They were afraid that the Jews would sort of have a monopoly over the Arabs. They wanted to control the Arabs. They wanted the oil. They wanted to make money. They wanted to control the Arabs.
Undoubtedly, Jacob, there are geopolitical interests involved here between the United States, Britain, France, the Arabs, the Arab nations, and certainly Israel is in the middle of all of that, and the Suez Canal plays big in that, and you would know, having fought in the Yom Kippur War. But what is the opinion of the people on the ground at the time, Jews and Arab alike, to the establishment of a Jewish state? What did the people there think?
Well, the Jews, of course, wanted it. There's no question. And the Arabs did not. They just did not want any foreigner there. They did not want Jews there. The leader of the Arab Palestinians, if you want to go, the Arab population in Israel, there was a clergyman named Haji Amin al-Husseini. He went to Europe and he helped Hitler. He gathered the people in Albania to fight with Hitler. They were very sympathetic to Hitler. And he was wanting Hitler to kill more and more of them so they would not come to Israel.
They have arrested our journalist, David Menzies. It is a false arrest. It is a political arrest. They arrested him because he was trying to do journalism, asking a question of a pro-Hamas protester, and they arrested him. There was a pro-Hamas protester. You probably recognize him. He's the guy who shouts hateful things at synagogues, at Jewish schools. He's the one who has been leading the Hamas rallies around Toronto. David was trying to interview him, and he said, I'm going to pray in the middle of the street right now. Okay, well, you go ahead. It's a public street. David can stand there. But no, the police came and pulled David off the street as if it became suddenly a Sharia street, a mosque or something. And then they later arrested him. They claimed he didn't show his ID to police, which is a requirement in Canada. But take a look at this. Those wicked liars are lying. Here is footage of David Menzies going through his wallet, pulling out ID to show the police, and they arrest him and put him in the back of a paddy wagon. Anyways, this is the Toronto police having a political bias. They are having two-tiered policing. Every weekend, the police abide hours and hours of hate marches, blasting at Jewish synagogues and Jewish schools. But some Iranian thug who is a pro-Hamas activist says this is now a mosque, and the police come in as if this is Iran with some Sharia enforcement. That is a violation of David's personal rights, a violation of his charter rights, and I swear to God that we will take steps against the Toronto police to take them to court, to have a court, to have a judge correct them and tell them that this is still a free country, and you cannot tell a journalist he is not allowed to be on a public street recording a public conflict in the public interest. You cannot enforce Sharia law on the streets of Toronto, and if these cops need to be told that by a judge, so be it. This is the second time that David Menzies has been harassed by police for political reasons in 2 months. Do you remember when Chrystia Freeland's bodyguards thought they would arrest him for asking questions too? Remember this?
Ms. Freeland, how come the IRGC is not a terrorist group? Why is your government supporting Islamo-Nazis? What? Excuse me. What are you doing?
You're under arrest for assault.
What, sir?
Why are you pushing me? You're under arrest for assault.
Well, we're suing those cops for $1 million. That's what you do when your charter rights are violated, because you need to get the police department's attention. You need to make it sting so they don't do it again.
You two wrote a song for Israel. It was about the tragedy that happened to the people at the music festival. You know how they can take people's lives, but you can't take their pride. I listened to it and I was moved. And the only thing I could think about was, I will never forgive the Hamas for making me listen to you two. Never again.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
I understand the British changed their position about a national home for Jews because they were starting to get feedback from the 70 million Muslims in the crown jewel of the British Empire, India, that don't continue doing this or you're going to lose our support over here. So that's one of the, again, geopolitical
Also,
forces upon them.
The Israeli underground didn't really fight the Arabs. They only fought the Arabs to retaliate. They fought the British. They wanted the British out of there because the British held back the immigration. The British made it very difficult for the Jewish people to live there. They would tell them, we are going to protect you. They would come to their homes, to small villages, look for weapons, and there were enough people that would give them information. They took the weapons. At night, the Arabs came in and killed as many as they could. It didn't happen once. It repeated itself in many places. And that's why the underground came up in Israel to fight the British. And when Arabs attacked the Jews, they would respond too. But their aim, the main target, was the British. And people in England, when they saw that British soldiers started to come dead and dead, dying people, there was a lot of pressure on them to get out of there. You know, in 1949, when the British left, they expected that Israel would be wiped out completely. In fact, they had British officers in the Jordanian army fighting, leading them.
Britain did not vote in favor for the resolution to create Israel. They abstained. There's a name given to British vacillating, changing their mind, saying one thing and then turning around and doing the other. And it's called Albion perfidy, the nature of Britain in the international community to not be trusted to do what they're saying that they want to do. To give it a name, you know, it has to happen a lot. But what do you think of the UN Resolution 181, which said, okay, here's the national home for Jews in Palestine. These are the territories that we're giving you. Your thoughts on 181?
There were many people that objected to it because they were promised the land since Britain severed the land east of the Jordan River. They were expected to have the land from the Jordan River to the sea. And the Britons reneged on it again. When they had the Peel Commission, they divided it, and then they brought it again in 47 to the UN. But Ben-Gurion said, no, at least we have something. And he was right, at least we had the home. The only unfortunate thing is that the home was not accepted by the Arabs. And there were no Palestinians then. This was Arab state. It was Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, all the countries surrounding it. So there was no issue of Palestinians. When Israel declared independence, five armies, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, Iraq's and soldiers, attacked Israel. And Israel survived. They wanted to literally throw the Jews to the sea. And they were broadcasting on radio for the Arabs to leave their homes, because we are coming to take it, and then you can come back and take your home. Well, I'm sorry. You can't do something, and it doesn't work out. Say, okay, no, I want my deal again. What happened before? You can't do that. It doesn't happen anywhere in the world. Only with the Muslims, with the Arab nations, because there are so many of them. They have the oil. They have so much power. And Israel really has nothing and has no friends. Look at the world today. They're really a far state diplomacy. There are no friends. Biden deserted them last week.
About that, the UN resolution to have a ceasefire, or at least the Security Council to have a ceasefire in Gaza right now, the United States abstained and let it happen. Do you think maybe the tide is turning as far as sentiment towards Israel goes in the West, who came out strongly behind Israel after October 7th? Everybody in the West more or less said, we're in favor of you defending yourself against the Hamas.
Yes.
But only is the tide turning?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it begins with the U.S. Look, Obama was determined that Iran will have a nuclear bomb. He was absolutely determined. In my opinion, I don't think he would have cared less if Iran would have dropped a nuclear bomb on Israel. That's my personal opinion. I don't think he would have cared. But when Biden came in, he renewed under pressure from Obama, I'm sure. But I don't think he can do anything. He's not capable mentally to do anything on his own.
Agreed.
So I'm sure there is pressure to continue to support Iran. Look, the Houthis are attacking American vessels. They are bombing empty warehouses in Yemen. They don't want... Hamas is one of the tentacles of Iran. Hezbollah is one of the tentacles. The Houthis are one of the tentacles. There are many other groups in Syria. If Israel goes into a fight with Hezbollah in the north, they will have a fight from Syria too. And Jordan. There are Iranian groups in Jordan. In Jordan, you know, Israel is really holding the monarchy there. Israel is supporting it. They're giving them water, they're giving them gas, they're giving them all kinds of help, protecting militarily. Because other countries know not to attack Jordan, because Israel needs Jordan to be there as a buffer.
242, the Six-Day War established that Israel, whether it's right or wrong, Israel cannot take territory by conquest. And Israel defied 242 with the help of the United States. There is no UN Security Council effort to enforce 242. What are your thoughts on the UN Resolution 242, which says that Israel must remove itself from the West Bank?
Why should I accept 242 when they don't want to accept the League of Nations mandate, which was a legal document? Why should I? Every time there was something, every new declaration, any new regulation, any new thing that they come up with is against Israel, making more difficult to Israel, shrink Israel, make it smaller, don't defend themselves. Oh, when they get hurt, oh, so sorry, but don't kill them. You can't live like that. You can't live like that. It's enough. It's enough.
Is there any distinction you would make between the culture and politics of the state of Israel with the culture and the politics of the surrounding Palestinian and Arab states that would entice people here in the West to support one or the other?
Well, I think automatically people in the West should support Israel because it is a Western country. It thinks like the West, it lives like the West, it walks like the West, democracy like the West, business like the West, culture like the West. Whereas in the other Arab countries and the Palestinian authorities, they are still 300 years behind. There's still barbarism there. Look what Saudi Arabia did to the reporter in Turkey. They cut him into pieces.
So we should support Israel because, well, I mean, technically they were Europeans who colonized the area, the European Jews, the Ashkenazis, and created the state of Israel.
You use the word colonized. I would not use it. There was no country. There was never any other country besides Israel then. There were other people that colonized it. There was the Crusaders, there was the Arabs, there was the Ottomans, there was the British. They were the ones colonizing it. No one ever owned it. No one ever ran it. No one ever operated the government there. There was never a state, a government, anybody that could say, this is our home. There was nothing. It was the Ottoman Empire for 400 years, and people came and go. And if you come, you need to get a permit. If you leave, you know, they control it militarily. There was nothing there. You can't say colonized. It's people coming home. They were not wanted anywhere in the world. There were pogroms in Russia, in Eastern Europe. They were kicked out of Spain in the 15th century. They were kicked out of Britain. Then they were called back to Britain because they needed the Jews. They needed money. You can't say colonized. This is not colonization. They came home. This is what Zionism is. The return to Zion, to Jerusalem. The return to home.
Okay, interesting. But I don't think that it's wrong to say that the people who moved there, emigrated there, were of European background, Poles, White Russians, Lithuanians, Germans, Austrian. They were European educated. They were backed by a lot of very wealthy Jews in Europe and governments in Europe to help establish a, basically, as you describe, a Western state in the Middle East.
Right.
So is this why you're saying that we should really support it? Because as compared to the Arab states, it is a much more classical liberal in its sentiment in politics. It is much more able to defend the individual rights of its citizens, Arab or Jew, as compared to the Arab states around it. So is this the comparison we should make between those two conditions?
In the early 60s, Egypt was fighting in Yemen. What do you have to do in Yemen? What do you have to do in Yemen? And killing Yemenites. And then they stopped and then they figured they have the army, they're going to Israel. But this is the Jewish, there's only one Jewish homeland. There are 43 Arab and Islamic countries in the world. 43. There are Christian countries in the world. Only one Jewish country. Small. Very small. Leave it alone. Leave it alone.
Understood. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the situation in Israel. The problem that we are up against with Israel and Gaza is that the Israeli Defense Force has been sent in to punish a population for what 25,000 to 30,000 people are responsible for doing. In other words, they've said that there is no distinction between the 25,000 or 30,000 members of Hamas and the population which contains them of about 2.2 to 2.3 million people. You make that argument, that's collective punishment. It would be similar to Moscow saying, well, the Americans are funding the stand-up and the equipping and modernization of the Ukrainian armed forces that have attacked us and threaten us and want to destroy us. So we need to kill the American people in order to stop this. So we are going to launch nuclear weapons to destroy population centers, killing 100 million Americans as a result of their government's decision to finance this war against us. Everyone would be horrified and say, out of the question. Well, that's exactly what's happening, unfortunately, today with Gaza. We are financing and supporting the Israelis who are on a campaign to ruthlessly expunge this population on the grounds that the whole population threatens them. Now, why does this make no sense? It makes no sense because we live in a world today where particularly Israel and its supporters in the United States and Europe have billions of dollars at their disposal. We could organize a repatriation or relocation of the people that are living in Gaza to better places with better standards of living if necessary. So the notion that the only solution is to murder the population is outrageous nonsense. It needs to stop. We should not support that. And this is from a person, in my case, that has always supported the Israeli state and its right to defend itself. This has nothing to do with defending Israel. This has everything to do with ethnic cleansing and destroying the populations the Israelis don't like that live on its borders. That's unacceptable. And the Israel lobby initially was set up
to advocate for the Israeli state. And that made a great deal of sense in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, when, to be perfectly blunt, there wasn't much support for Israel anywhere. That's changed. And today, we do support the existence of the Israeli state. What we don't support is what I just described. And unfortunately, the lobby has now identified itself with this genocidal policy, which is unacceptable to me and others like me who support Israel. So that's why we call for an unconditional ceasefire, as opposed to what is being suggested, which is anything but an unconditional ceasefire.
I saw her broken body. I went insane. My hatred exploded, and in an instant of grief, I destroyed the Hushnak.
Why did you try to hide this from all of us? Was it out of guilt for not helping Rishon and the others when they were alive?
No. You don't understand the scope of my crime. I didn't kill just one Hushnak, or 100, or 1,000. I killed them all. All Hushnak. Everywhere.
Is it moral? Let me put it that way. Is it moral to have a state based on an ethnicity or religion? I know it's a secular state, but it's called a Jewish state, and now with the basic law under the Likud party government, it is being even more entrenched as a Jewish state where Jews are the only people there who have the right to self-determination, as it's mentioned in the basic law. Is that a moral thing to do, to set up a nation based on an ethnic, cultural identity and a religion?
The Palestinian Authority would not allow any Jew to live there. Arab countries would not allow any Jew to live there. Why look at Israel only? Out of necessity, yes, there are close to 2 million Arabs in Israel. They are the smartest of them all. They live the best in Israel than in any other Arab country in the whole area. They have the best life, the most freedom, the best education, the best medical school. You know, you go to the hospital in Israel, nurses and doctors, so many Arabs from within Israel, not from the West Bank. Judea and Samaria, from within Israel. A number of years ago, my brother passed away. I went to Israel while he was in the hospital, and his doctor was an Arab, the nurses were Arab. It was normal. It was accepted. There was nobody raised an issue. Nobody made, there was nothing different. They are citizens of the country, and they participate in everything in the country. They even have members of parliament who call for the destruction of the country. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine if there was a party in Canada against Trudeau that wanted to destroy Canada?
Well, even some would say that the Liberal and NDPs want to.
Job.
They are.
He's doing a good job on his own.
Yes, it's already gone, if you ask me. Given the broad definition of genocide in the Geneva Conventions on genocide, I don't know if you've read it, have you?
I didn't read it.
It's not what you think it is. If you think that it means the extermination, the killing of an entire population, it can mean as little as offending a single person of a group.
When was this definition of genocide created?
Oh, 49, I think, something like that. It was after the Holocaust, and it was actually defined by a Jew. Right now, what I want to talk about right now is the International Court of Justice in South Africa's allegation that Israel is committing genocide, I put that in air quotes, against the Gazans. Since genocide can mean in whole or in part, even moving people, preventing pregnancies, things of that nature are now termed genocide, offending somebody. What is your thought on the International Court of Justice and the allegations brought forward by South Africa that Israel is committing genocide, so-called, in Gaza?
Okay, so you want genocide, I'll tell you genocide. The population in Gaza, based on the United Nations, in 1960, there were 265,000 people in Gaza. 1970, 342. 1990, 645. In 2000, 1.1 million. 2010, 1.5 million. 2023, 2.3 million people in Gaza. I don't know what kind of genocide this is. I mean, people multiply like crazy.
I'm going to try to look up.
However, there is a genocide attempt against the Jews. Read the Hamas manifest. Read the Hamas manifest. And whoever claims that the Jews are conducting genocide, let him explain the Hamas manifest. Paragraph 7, paragraph 4. And let him see what they say about that. Is this, they are calling for the extermination of Israel and every Jew in the world. This is what they're doing. So who's guilty of genocide?
We've seen the United States go in and the West go in coalitions sometimes, or just simply by the United States itself, go into other countries in the world all over the planet to further their interests, sending troops into countries all over the world to further their interests. Why don't we see American troops helping Israel in Gaza?
Israel doesn't want them.
Oh, interesting.
Israel doesn't want them.
I don't blame them.
I don't blame them either. No, Israel doesn't want them. I have a problem with Israel too right now. And I've had this problem for a long time. In the Yom Kippur War, Henry Kissinger blocked the flow of weapons to Israel, to support them, the replacement weapons. And it was, surprisingly, it was Nixon, who they called anti-Semite at the time. He made some comments against the Jews. He was the one that said, no, I must support Israel. And he made sure that the flow of weapons would go back to Israel. Not Kissinger. Kissinger did not want Israel to win the war in the Yom Kippur War. He warned Golda Meir not to start the war. He wanted the Arabs to have some pride. So when they negotiate, they'll have a better card. They don't do it with any country in the world. They did it with Israel. In my opinion, after this war, especially maybe not right then, they didn't have much money, but they have high tech today that brings a lot of money to the country. They have energy, natural gas, that they sell to Egypt. From there, they sell to other places. They sell to Jordan. They literally give it away to Jordan, very cheap. And for the country, so they don't have to spend money on getting imports. So they have the money. Why did they not build more factories, more arms, not to rely on the U.S.? Because to me, they are relying too much on the U.S.
Yeah, I would agree with you that any nation that has to rely on the largesse or the support of a foreign country for their existence exists very tenuously. And so what would happen if the United States, and it seems that it may move in this direction, if not now with Biden, certainly not with Trump, but perhaps in the future, 10, 30, 40 years from now, if the United States all of a sudden joins the rest of the world who are against Israel and says that, no, 242, you have to get out. What happens to Israel then?
Well, it happened already. Trump recognized Jerusalem. He recognized the Golan Heights. He recognized that people are allowed to live in Judea and Samaria. And Blinken is saying, no, they're not allowed to. It already happened.
So the American position is vacillating.
One administration, that they're jumping and changing it.
I do want to ask you in closing here, what is your suggestion as to achieving peace in the Middle East?
There isn't going to be peace.
There will never be peace?
I don't say never. I don't know about never. But there's not going to be peace in the foreseeable future. As long as you have such a huge body of people, a huge number of countries and people wanting the destruction of the Jewish people and Israel, there is not going to be peace. There's not going to be a two-state solution. Because what two-state? Israel pulled out of Gaza in 1995. And the one that pulled out was Ariel Sharon, who was a military heroic that supposedly dealing with an iron fist against the Palestinians. He walked out. He said, you know what? Let's see. He walked out. They evacuated 10,000 people. They had industry there. They were growing hydroponic vegetables. And in a Jewish religion, when you cannot eat lettuce just like that. You have to soak it in water with salt because in case there are bugs, you're not allowed to eat bugs. So they were able to grow it in such a way there were no bugs. So it went all over the world, the Jewish communities all over the world, because they loved it. And it went to Europe. It was a great success, great industrial success. So this was the second time that Israel pulled out Jewish settlers, the Jewish villagers, farmers, one from Sinai, when they made peace with Egypt. They refused to give Israel a little peace for the war. And Begin said, okay. And they left us with Gaza, and Sharon left Gaza in 2005. They destroyed those farms because they employed Arab workers. They figured, okay, you'll keep the workers there. You have industry, there's something to eat. They destroyed it. Went to the world begging for money. There is not going to be peace. When they build such a maze of tunnels, and they do the same in Lebanon, by the way, Hezbollah. They have the same in Lebanon, and they have a lot more rockets, and they have a lot more access to weapons than Gaza did, because they have Syria, and they have the sea. There isn't going to be any two-state solution. You know, I was in the war in 73, and I was inside Egypt, going from one place to another, and we saw a wounded Egyptian soldier. We could have killed him easily. We picked him up, we put him in our vehicle, we drove to where the field hospital, and we took him there. And I'll tell you, many, many days in my life, I regret doing that, considering seeing what's happening today with how Israel is being treated. Many days in my life, I regret sending that person.
Is there room for a United Nations effort, if it ever came to that, to assist that area of the world to at least stop killing each other? Is there room for the UN?
There are 48 Arabs and Muslim countries in the UN. Unless they form a new organization called the United Democratic Nations.
Interesting, yeah.
It's not going to change.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure meeting you again, Jacob. Thank you for your input and thank you for your insight. Shalom.
Shalom, shalom. Thank you for having me.
I have to confess that I was a little saddened to learn that Jacob regretted having saved that wounded Egyptian soldier. But I can certainly understand the sentiment behind it, given the lack of perceived reciprocity on the part of the enemy. My guess, however, is that that Egyptian soldier had different feelings about that entirely. Or maybe not, which is a possibility to consider. They say it takes two to tango, but only one to start a conflict. Given that premise, then the next logical question would be along the lines of, so how many does it take to stop a conflict? That sounds a lot like the challenge facing all of us trapped in our state-induced zeitgeist of infinite conflicts. There's a phrase for you. If there's one major consolation to the dilemma of no peace in the foreseeable future, it is the reality that no one can ever really see or predict the future. The future is never foreseeable, even when it appears to cooperate with our expectations. How did the foreseeable future look to you, say, only 5 years ago? Didn't see this coming, did you? And while we're on the subject of foreseeable futures, try to picture yourself in the foreseeable future. Joining us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
I don't mean to brag, but in Israel we do have the only subway that is above ground. You know, you would think, why don't we just build a subway like every other normal country has, right? Like in France and US and Spain and whatever. Well, let me tell you. You see, we're Jews. We don't really build things anymore. You know, we would have to let the Arabs build the subway for us. We would have to let the Arabs dig out the tunnels for us. And how do I put this? Jews and tunnels that Arabs dug out never gotten along that great.